The CFRN E-Mini Futures Cast is now on Stitcher. Listen to us on your iPhone, Android phones, BlackBerry, and WebOS phones. Stitcher is smart radio for your phone. Find it in your app store or at Stitcher.com. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio.
Are you ready, Steve?
Uh-huh.
Andy?
Yeah!
Bert? Well, all right, fellas. Let's go!
You're listening to CFRN, the Christian Financial Radio Network.
Today's broadcast is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/CFRN. Over 85,000 titles. Choose from mystery, romance, religion, science, technology, business, New York Times bestsellers, even children's books. You name it, Audible has it. With 85,000 titles to choose from, you're sure to find the perfect audiobook for yourself or to give as a gift, and it's absolutely free. Just point your browser to audibletrial.com/CFRN. That's audibletrial.com/CFRN. And become a part of the audiobook revolution by downloading your free audiobook today. audibletrial.com/CFRN.
Hey, trader, want to get rich quick? Well, good luck with that. If, on the other hand, you actually want to learn how to trade, the place to be is www.cfrn.net. Tune in Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Eastern, for our daily devotional, and then spend the next 3 hours learning how it's done from professional traders who actually trade for a living. That's www.cfrn.net. Every trading day from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. CFRN, a community of believers who trade for a living.
Good afternoon, traders, and welcome back to the CFRN E-Mini Futures Cast. This is the daily broadcast of indeterminate length, where we discuss all things E-Mini, along with some really big ideas on the finer points of trading gold, bonds, crude, sugar, the euro, and even T-bills. Joining us today from our studios in Boston, Mr. Michael Bork. From our trading desk in Chicago, Mr. Burton Schlichter. And from our studios in Las Vegas, Nevada, Mr. David Williams. Now, to get things started, let's go to our host and founder in Studio A, overlooking South Mountain, America's largest city park. Here's Dwayne.
Good afternoon. Welcome back. Today is Wednesday, 26th day of February, 2013. Man, we got a big show today. It's a really big show. Let's take a look at the numbers. The Dow up 37, 50. S&P up 4.5. NASDAQ up 23. Now, these are the cash index numbers. They always are at the top of the show. Crude is up 86 cents a barrel. Gold down 1660. Is this the start of what we've been hinting? I don't know. We'll take a look at the chart in a bit. By the way, happy Wednesday. It's officially hump day. We're over the hump. Nothing naughty. We're just, you know, after today, two more days, slide right into the weekend. If you're a young man, that's a big deal. You're pretty excited about that. You get to be a man of a certain age. You know, every day that passes goes by faster and faster and faster. And, wow. So, for me, today's Wednesday. It can stay Wednesday for like a while. It can stay Wednesday for weeks. I'd be okay with that. All right? But it's not going to. And so, I've got to deal with that reality. Now, if you're a first-time visitor, however you found us, doesn't matter. Even if you can't remember how you found us, doesn't matter. welcome. We're so glad you found us. Grab your day planner, pencil us in 12 noon to 2 p.m. Eastern, Monday through Friday, for the rest of your life. All right? I'll wait. No, I'm kidding. It's when you have a chance to do that. Seriously, we've been at this 8 years. Got a birthday coming up in April. We'll be 9 years old. That's exciting. Just this morning, someone asked, did you ever see yourself being in this line of work? And my answer was, no, not in my wildest dreams. Kind of just happened. Although, I got to say, there were some things. God has this incredible way of orchestrating your life and bringing all the pieces of the puzzle together many, many, many moons ago. My wife and I did volunteer work at the Veterans Hospital in Phoenix, Arizona. Those of you familiar with Phoenix, you're familiar with the VA. It's a big, huge complex on the corner of 7th Street and Indian School, I believe it is. Anyway, we saw a little ad, I think in the New Times. They were looking for volunteers. They had an in-house radio station. Now, I was probably 22 years old at that time, 21, 22, somewhere there. And we followed up. It sounded interesting. What's an in-house? What is an in-house radio station? Well, turns out they had a little studio at the VA hospital. And if you were a patient in the room, you know how you have the little thing on your bed and you can watch TV or sometimes you can listen to the radio? Well, one of the selections was the in-house radio station. Or if you were just out in the hallway or one of the common areas or at the nurse's station, those little speakers overhead, they were playing the in-house radio station. And so my wife and I volunteered, and we went down and filled out our application and pitched ourselves, and they wanted to know, well, what kind of radio experience do you have? And we told them, none. But apparently they really needed volunteers, because even though our experience was none, we got the job. And so for 2 hours a week, for I don't know how long we did it, 2 hours a week, we'd go down, I believe it was a Thursday night, and man, we would just radio our little hearts out. We had music and we had pre-recorded stuff, and this was before the home computer. This was before the PC era, right? And so any pre-recorded stuff that we did, we had to do it on like a boombox and a cassette tape and like a Mr. Microphone kind of a thing. It was funny. It was hilarious. We were two crazy, mixed up young kids, madly in love. We still are. And we had a great time. And so I said that to say this: whatever God's doing in your life today, right now, and he's always doing something. You may not see the reason, may not make any sense, but he's teaching you, training you, grooming you for something. And so I had a lot of living and a lot of, you know, blind alleys to go down from that little in-house radio station to the CFRN studios. I mean, an entirely different career, the whole nine yards. But here I am. I've come all the way around the mountain, and I'm back behind the microphone now for 9 years. I also did a very short stint, an hour a week at a local AM Christian radio station for about 6 months, but that wasn't my cup of tea. And so CFRN was born out of some angry men who were mad as hell, and we weren't going to take it anymore. We were sick and tired of what was going on Wall Street with naked shorting. We felt that the government, the very watchdog agencies that had been assigned to protect us, were duplicitous in the crime. And so we needed a platform to tell the world. And I said, okay. There was me and Mark Falk and Patrick Byrne, CEO of Overstock.com. Rod Young from Eagle Tech, Bud Burrell. Bud Burrell, by the way, introduced me to our special guest today. Coming up at 1 p.m. Eastern, this will be the third Wednesday in a row, we have had the pleasure, the great pleasure, of having on this radio program Mr. Wayne Jett. He's the author of the book, The Fruits of Graft. If you've not been to his website, you should go there real quick and educate yourself before he comes on. It's classicalcapital.com, just like classical music, classicalcapital.com. Now, obviously, you can't read the book between now and the time he comes on at the top of the hour, but you can get an idea, you can get a flavor of who he is, what he's all about, and when he comes on, you'll be able to ask him questions, which brings me to my next point. If you're new to this radio program and you don't see a chart up in front of you, let me make sure, there we go. If you don't see that chart, you're not fully logged in, we can fix that in 30 seconds. Go to our homepage at cfrn.net. On the right-hand side, click the big microphone. That'll take you to a page. Follow those instructions. 30 seconds, you'll see the charts, and you'll have access to the chat box. If you got comments, you got questions, you like what we say, you don't like what we say, hey, we're interested in your opinion, even if it doesn't agree with ours. Type it in, all right? And once Wayne comes on the show today, if you have questions for him about his book, about his theories, about his philosophy, type it in. As time permits, he'll be with us for the full hour from 1 p.m. to 2 p.m. Eastern. We'll get as much in there as we can during that hour. And then I'm going to invite him back next Wednesday. Don't know if he'll accept, but I sure hope he does. And so that's how you do it. Now, we start each day with our good word for the day. Michael cannot be here today, had another appointment. He was in the live trading room this morning. He pulled it off, got those points. I do have the spreadsheet, which is here, and he'll be happy to mail that out to anybody that would like a copy of it. I'm going to give you a rundown of what happened. Beans, we were down 8 ticks. The Russell, we were up 15 ticks. Natural gas, we're up 11 ticks. Crude, down 12 ticks. Gold, up 8 ticks. The end of the day, when the dust settled, did we make our daily goal of $100 per contract per day? Yes, we did. And if I'm not mistaken, I think he said it took him 15 trades to do that, which is, you know, more than normal, but stay with me. 15 times 6, you know. Did most of that go to commissions today? Unfortunately, it did. But when you look at the spreadsheet, you'll see that in most cases, most days, we get to that daily goal in the first trade or the first two trades or the first three trades. Some days it takes 5 trades. Here's our belief, and this is a great day to share this. If you can make the $100 per contract per day in 10 trades or less, then you're going to do just fine. And you go, hey, wait a minute, foul. It took him 15. Yeah, I know. But yesterday it only took 5. Yeah, but today it took 15. Well, see, yesterday the 5 he didn't use, well, those rolled over to today. And on Tuesday or Monday, when it took him 3 trades, the 7 he didn't use rolled over. And then last week and the week before and the week before, so he probably just in the last 2 weeks when he came in this morning, he probably had, if we just look at the last 2 weeks, he probably had 60, 70 rollover trades to work with. So yeah, today it took him 15, but it's no big deal. It could have taken him a lot more than that. And he'd still be on track. If you want to know more about that blueprint, get a hold of me. If you're on the free trial, you should request some private tutoring, some private mentoring. You should say, dude, please tell me how in the heck I can make money at $100 a day per contract and 10 trades. I mean, commissions. It'll just eat it all up. No. No, it won't. I'll be happy to spend some time with you. You know, we've got to schedule it. Got a lot of partners. They come first. But if you're on the free trial and you want some personal one-on-one time, ask. Send an email to support@cfrn.net. Either myself or Michael or Bert or Leslie, one of us will hop on a private go-to meeting with you if necessary, or maybe just a phone call, whatever it takes to get the question answered for you so that you fully understand. We'll do it. Now, a funny thing happened this morning. Well, funny, it's relative. But someone in the live trading room said, hey, can you explain to me what stop to break even means? We say that, I don't know how many times a day, every day. Michael explains it. But one of the folks who is a partner in the live trading room didn't really understand what that meant. I explained it one time, and I made a little diagram, and he said, oh my goodness, now it's crystal clear. I perfectly understand what that means. I've been sitting here for a month trying to figure it out. Now that's an amazing thing about learning. One person could say something to you 100 times and you just sit there like a frog in a hailstorm. You don't know what, you don't get it. And then somebody else comes along and says virtually the exact same thing, but they put some different, they use it one different word or a diagram or put a little different spin on it. And all of a sudden you go, oh, well, why didn't you just say that? Well, he did. But see, so the learning experience in itself is an amazing thing. If you have questions, if you don't understand, I'm so glad that person reached out to me this morning rather than just sitting there and not knowing, not fully understanding, because this today the scales fell from his eyes and he's like, man, now it all makes sense. I get it. So if you're sitting out there with those kinds of questions, whether you're a partner, whether you're on a free trial, or you're just a civilian passing through, hey, we want to help you. That's why we're here. That's why we do this, okay? So email us, support@cfrn.net. Call us, 949-42-EMINI. We'll do our very best to get you well on your journey up Trader Mountain. All right, let's go to the good word for the day. It really is good. We're going to talk for just a moment about core values. What are your core values? You know, I'm always asking you, what do you really believe? And I ask you to write it down and then question why you believe it. And I want you to actually fill in the blanks. Well, not only do I believe this, but this is why I believe it. Okay? So today the question a little different. What are your core values? Let's go to Romans. It says, for all who are being led by the Spirit of God, these are the sons of God. That's Romans 8:14. There's a lot of talk these days about core values, those characteristics that identify priorities for your company, for your family, for your life. Now, let me share with you the number one core value, or what I should believe, what I believe should be the core value in the church. Now, when I say in the church, I don't mean the building I go to on Sunday or the building that you go to on Sunday. I mean the church. And the word says that you and I, we are the church. It has nothing to do with stone, brick and mortar, stained glass. That's just a meeting place. We are the church. Okay, moving on. I want you to think about this. Jesus poured his life into the lives of 12 ordinary men. Fishermen. They weren't highly educated in any way. But yet he chose to invest most of his time, most of his public ministry, with them. At one point, he even washed their feet. Now, That's the act of a slave or a servant. He healed the sick. He loved the poor. He was concerned about the widow and the orphan and the person who was left out. He loved kids. He got angry when the religious leaders put the legalism of the law before the love of God and the love for people. Even when mankind, those Roman soldiers, were murdering him on the cross, as they drove the spike, he chose to forgive. Word says there was a legion of angels there just waiting to smite everybody, right? But no, he didn't call on them. They were there. He could have just nodded his head or wiggled his nose like, what's her name, on TV. But he didn't. He looked at that guy and says, well, he looked at the guy, then he looked heavenward and said, Father, forgive them. They know not what they do. Jesus was totally dedicated to doing the will of God, yet he was still loving, compassionate, and forgiving with people. Do you have that kind of balance in your life? We all fall short, but what a model we have to follow. The ideal that he set for us in everyday, ordinary living. The number one core value in the church should be this and nothing more, to be more like Jesus in spirit and in character. What's your core value? Think about that. Ask yourself that question. And that's our good word for the day. So now we'll go to the chart. S&P 500 E-mini futures. Back on Monday, was it? 2 p.m. Eastern. Little voice said, we're looking at the high of the S&P for some time to come. And I went through a whole explanation of how, you know, I'm not given to those types of forecasts and predictions and whatnot. It's just not what I do. But this really weighed heavily on me. And so, you know what? I'm just going to share it, get it out of my head, off my chest, and be done with it. And so, is that going to hold? I have no idea. So far it has, you know. I'm a hero for a couple days, so we'll leave it at that. Now, since then, what happened? We had a tweet that said, consider being short 1840 to 38. That worked out good. Remember, these are last week's zones. Tomorrow, Thursday, I'll begin to share, or I will share, this week's trading zones with everybody. Partners get the zones before the market opens every Monday morning, okay? Think of it as a football field that doesn't have the lines drawn on it yet. That's what your chart is. I send you out the zones, you draw the lines. You know where the 50 is and the 40 and the 30 and the 20. You know where the end zone is. You know where the goalposts are, okay? And then you just watch over the course of the week as price comes and prints those candles and fills in all that blank space, white space, gray space, black space, however you have your chart set up. Okay. We then had a tweet that said, consider being long 1848 to 1850. Now, as you know, we have a belief that I go on and on about, that important prices and important areas are almost always tested. It's what I call a market truth, because I really believe it is the truth. Not because somebody told me, but somebody did tell me a long, long time ago, but I have myself tested it over the years and watched it. And I have now written it officially on the tablet of my heart. Okay? That and the weekly zones, I truly believe that they're going to provide support or resistance, whatever the proper context is at the time. That price will coil, consolidate, pause, relax, make up its mind what it's going to do next, and it will go from zone to zone to zone, and sometimes, you know, back to the zone. So, with that said, if we were to take these lines right here, this 1848, and we were to drag that thing way across, and then we did the same thing with the 1850, drag that all the way across. Okay, I think we got two straight lines. Hey, that's pretty good. So the tweet said, consider being long 48 to 50. Okay, that went off real swell. No hitches there. And then price came back down. And last night we had a tweet that said, consider being short 1846. We always have a two-point target on our tweets or trade alerts. And so 1844, which was a zone from last week, that was the target. Okay? So right there, target 1844. All right. And then what happened next? The market found support, bounced, and it bounced right up through 1848 to 1850. When I talk about important prices and important areas being tested, that thing right there, that's what I'm talking about. Now, sometimes we'll just see a string of them go off. We had, if I go back over here with this 1837, that thing just went again and again and again. This one down here, every one of those yellow arrows is that particular tweet going off again and again and again. Now I've jumped way past. See all those yellow arrows? There they are again. So that's just something that happens, and it's the nature of the market. I don't make it do that. I don't have that kind of power. Not quite. It's something I observed. It is the behavior of the market. And so once we determine that something is a market truth, not because somebody said it, but because we've observed it over time and know it to be truth, we can then use that to our advantage. And so this is just an example of that. Over here, 48 to 50. Over here, 48 to 50 once, twice, and now it's trying to do it a third time. Okay? All right. With that, we can move on to crude oil. Oh, because that just popped up. Mind of a trader. Guy's working. Remember I tell you about the code? You write the code looks good. You know, you hit the button and it doesn't do exactly what it's supposed to do. Very good chance, very, very good chance that by tomorrow morning, by the time the market's open, you'll be able to go to the homepage and you'll be able to catch your first episode of The Mind of a Trader. And once it appears on our homepage, then every day, Monday through Friday, you're going to get a brand new episode for the next 160 trading days. Yep. And each one's about 12 to 17 minutes in length. Each one has the ability to change your trading, and if you apply it on a larger scale, change your life. It's a true story. Next, crude oil. Last night, we had a tweet that said, consider being short below 101.85, target 101.75. In crude, we need 10 ticks to make our $100 per contract per day. With the S&P and a couple of others, it only takes 8 ticks because those pay $12.50 per tick. This one, it just came right on down, did the deal. These are hourly candles, did it in an hour. And then in the next, it took 2 hours for that one, or an hour and a few minutes for the second one to complete. And so that was the first one that triggered last night. And so on the blog page where you should be following us, let me refresh this page. I'll put this link in the chat box here in a bit, the eMini Google Plus community. All right. Oh, I see what it is. You don't need this part at the end. Control A, Control C. All right, I'm putting it in the chat box. Best place to follow us. And let me hit send all. And there it is. And for those of you that don't do so well with the copy and paste, I'm going to go to the other chat box. I'm going to put it in there. And that will automatically turn it into a hyperlink. Now, when you get there, you've got a request to follow us, and then I'll approve you, and piece of cake. All right. So the crude, it went off, it happened, and I wrote, per the last alert, your day's done. If you shorted the crude at 101.85, put down the mouse, pick up a good book. Seriously, okay? Part of our 24-month graduate program is teaching you discipline. And when you're hot and on a roll, it's very difficult to put down the mouse and go read a book. You need to learn, along with learning how to read a chart, technical analysis, the mechanics of placing an order, you also need to learn some discipline, okay? A few other things you need to learn too, like patience. This is all designed so that at the end of the 24-month period, you have an account size that you've built up with profits you actually earned in the market. Not another deposit, but with profits you earned in the market, you built it up to the size it will support, more than support, trading 20 contracts. But even more important, you are prepared psychologically, skill-wise, on every level. You've matured as a trader. As your account size grew, you matured as a trader. And that's how that works. Okay, if you want more information, let me know. So the crude, it's traded significantly higher today. Last night on the soybeans, we had a tweet that said, consider being long from 86 to 88. It triggered once, and it came back around and triggered a second time. And since I drew, now this is a 5-minute chart. Why am I showing a 5-minute chart today and I think I've got a 15-minute? Because I want you to know that there's no magical time frame. Sometimes people think my hourly chart, ooh, that's magic. No, there's no magical time frame. Markets are fractal in nature. Okay? What does that mean? It means if it's relevant on a, if it happens, if you can see it on a 1-minute chart, it'll also show up on a daily chart, a weekly chart, a monthly chart. Okay? Go to our blog and type in fractal, and I'll give you, and you can get a better explanation as to my interpretation of what that statement means. So we sent out the alert on the soybeans, consider being long, 86 to 88. 2 pennies in the beans is the same as 2 S&P points or $100 per contract per trade. So we had it once, we had it twice. And then this morning, we got below it, which is key, and then we hit it for a third time. But again, remember, you only need one of them. You don't need all three. If you took all three, well, I mean, you made money, but you're not really playing by the rules. Now, are you? All right. Russell, last night we said in our alert, consider being short below 1176.50 down to the target at 1175.50. Okay, we overshot it by a little bit, which is good. That means we traded through the target. This means everybody got filled. We only need 1 point in the Russell, 10 ticks. That's it. S&P requires 2 points, 8 ticks, the Russell, 1 point, 10 ticks. I know it sounds a little confusing, but if you Google CFRN contract specifications, it'll all become crystal clear. That happened once, and then it happened a second time, then it happened a third time, and then it happened a fourth time. So that whole important prices and important areas are almost always tested. That's why I say it, because it's true. We did nothing last night on the euro. The Canadian dollar, we don't trade the Canadian dollar in the live trading room, but it was brought up on the show last week. David brought it up. I think he's got a trade going on in it with all the people who are part of the Williams Edge. And then on the after show, someone asked me to take a look at it, and so I threw out an idea, consider being short 90.12 down to 90.02. Okay, that thing got triggered and stopped out earlier on in the week, but last night it finally actually did the deal and then some. But we did not have a specific alert out last night. We talked about this last week. Okay, last night on the bonds, we didn't do anything. And these, I'm going to get the zones updated tonight. So tomorrow when you come to the show, you'll see this week's zones, and they've done their job as they're supposed to. What's next? Oh, that was just a four-tick range. Oh, the gold. There's gold in them hills. Mm-hmm. All right. Let's talk about, no, let's get David in here and talk to him, because I know he's got a thing or two. So we're looking for price to break 1299. It may or may not break it. If it does, we're going to party on the way down. If it doesn't break it, then hey, it doesn't break it. We're long-term bullish on gold anyway. So if you go out to the Google Plus page, follow that link, request a follow, and I approve you, you can go through and read my commentary, which sometimes I wax 89 lines long. It gives you a little warning that you're about to, you know, stumble into. There's a ton of content here. I really should be putting this on the website, but this is just so much easier. Someday I'll get all this transferred over to the website, but for now, I'm just taking advantage of the simplicity. So, let me pause for a brief station identification, and I'll be right back with Mr. David Williams from PageTrader.com. Don't touch the radio dial. We're coming right back at you.
You're listening to CFRN, a community of believers who trade for a living. To learn more about who we are, what we do, and how we do it, call toll-free 1-866-928-3310, and we'll send you out a no-obligation information kit absolutely free. 866-928-3310.
Come in early on him. Okay. This is normally where David says, good morning, Dwayne. All right. Well, we'll turn off his intro music, and I'll send him a really quick text message that says, we're ready for you. And I'm just going to, here you go. I just played your song, David, or should I say our song? Question mark. All right, that'll bring him running. Okay, so let me go to the chat box and see if there are any questions. See, we did the 50 to 48 twice. Now we're doing it backwards. So from here, if we come back down, then that's going to count, you know, as a, I guess, a third one.
I'm in, Dwayne.
There he is. I already played your music.
Sorry.
I won't do it again. But
well,
yeah, I just thought we were, you know.
Start early.
So are you busy? I mean, I can yammer on about something else if you're tied up.
Oh, you can yammer on. No, I can yammer on. No, we can both yammer on. I'm fine.
We're the yammerers.
Yeah.
Coming to a
the yammerons.
Near you.
I apologize for missing that as well, because I thought it would be probably another 5 or 7 minutes before you're on, but that's fine. We're,
right.
We're
well, because
go.
We have the guest coming at 1, I thought 1 Eastern, I just thought maybe you and I would have a chance to chat a little bit beforehand.
Sure, absolutely.
And Iris, I see your suggestion. Thank you for that. But what happened, see, I had to change my horizontal line because I want it to have the number and the letters. So I had to change the default setting. So that's why sometimes you see me fidgeting around trying to take this tool and draw a straight line. I'm getting better at it. So, but thank you very much for the suggestion. And I just wish they'd give me 2 and then I'd be good to go. But anyway, David, what's new in your world?
Well, I wish I could give you something really exciting, but all I can say is it's the same old boring thing, you know, just watching a whole bunch of markets and trying to make a couple bucks. But I really love it. You know,
I know.
I would do this for free. It's so much. It's so good. You know, but the funny thing is that I think a lot of people probably would do it for free. But we just can't. You have to get paid sometimes, you know.
You do.
The ultimate thing is if you get it right, the system pays you. And the markets are, and everybody knows this, these markets are more volatile than usual. That means there's more sachets and spikes and twists and turns in there on the way to perhaps completing your indication, can be. And there's also very fast directional moves, like what we recently saw in gold on the way up, that can be very satisfying as well. And one of the things, if I had to give a basic little goodie that's been good for me, is that I make an effort to not have whatever my previous trade was, however it worked out, actually have an influence on my next trade with regard to certainty. In other words, if the trade worked and or if it was really extraordinary, I don't want that to make me extra certain about my next trade where I normally wouldn't be. If the trade was a break even or a loss, I don't want that to make me extra concerned on the next trade either. I want to keep a very neutral view, or my normal view would might be better, and not have be swung around by what the market just did in a trade, win, lose, or draw. And so you might ask yourself, for people that are listening, that if that's something that you have happened, which is to have your previous trade sort of dictate to you in some way how you should feel. We're human beings. We have emotions. We're going to feel a certain way about things. The job isn't to try to not feel that. That's not what I'm saying. And for many years, I used to think that that was the thing. Well, just act like you don't feel it. No, the fact is you do feel it. That's the fact. If you can actually come in direct contact with that, with the fact that you do feel it, you won't have to make big efforts to overcome it. It's the resistance to it that keeps it pinned in place, the resistance, and meaning that I don't like this feeling, I don't like the way I feel about what I just did, or I'm as high as a kite because I just did a great trade. You know, those things get pinned into place by like and dislike. And so if you can, I don't want to go on all to it, but the bottom line is that just let it go and go back to normal trading. And that's, you'll do much better that way over time than you will getting swung around by admittedly, your own emotions about your own trade. So hope that's a little something that's helpful. It really helps me because I don't want to be swung either way.
Yeah.
I want to just be normal, as if that's impossible.
That's what I try so hard to tell people, when, especially, and this is a really, it's kind of hard to, people call you, like someone becomes a new partner, and they're really getting the hang of things, and they have an unusually freakishly good day, and so they call me, and they're pumped, and they're excited, and, you know, and they, it somehow dawns on them that I'm not sharing their enthusiasm on the same level that they're at. I don't want to rain on their parade. I don't want them to think that I'm not happy for them and proud of them and excited because of their progress. But I know what the flip side of that coin looks like. I know what it's like to see a man tap dance on his desktop. And I know what it's like to see the same man curled up in a fetal position under his desk. And so what we strive for is middle of the road. I mean, plain vanilla. Mediocrity. I joke about that word, but really, that what David is saying, guys, is there's so much meat on that bone. Really think about that. Don't get overly carried away with a good day, and don't beat yourself up too hard over the rough day. Just strive for the average day, and have peace with that. Is that what you're trying to say, David? Did I get that right?
If you actually, I think yes. And if you don't let yourself get too, or not let yourself, but if you recognize that you want to have throw a party when you have a good trade or whatever, and understand, and get over that, then you'll find that the swings on the downside aren't anywhere near as bad as they are. It's like, right, if you allow yourself to go one direction, you kind of, like the market, end up having to go the same distance in the other direction. So if you cut one of them out, the other ones kind of fall into place as well. And really, in the end, you kind of want to just be a little bit of a scientist with the market, and simply the profits maybe are piling up somewhere, but you're not really there entirely for that. You're sort of, if you want to think of it in kind of a movie scene, you're there studying the effects, and you're buying and selling and so on, but you're not making a big deal out of the actual net results. You're simply going back to work and doing the work of a trader, researcher, you know, whatever you want to think of yourself as. So
yeah.
I think of myself as somebody that, you know, I think I'm actually more of a perhaps researcher than I am a trader in the market. But trading comes along with it because you want to take advantage of your research. You know, you want to put it to work. You want to see some gain from it, and that's very possible to do with these markets.
Very possible to do. You know, everybody's got their own horror story about the markets, but there are people who really do make money in the markets on a fairly regular basis. So it's not like you're shooting for something that can't happen or is never going to happen. You just got to figure out what it's going to take to make it happen for you. That's what you've got to strive for. Don't have unrealistic expectations. You know, you can look at the stars, but keep your feet on the ground. That's what I say.
That's right.
David, I'm going to share some news with you. I had other news, but then I just saw this news, and you have a little puppy dog, right?
I do.
What does your puppy dog say to you when you come home every day?
He sings a song to me each night. And it's the sweetest thing. He's a little schnauzer, and he's a pound dog. And somebody gave him to me at one point, and I was never really crazy about schnauzers. But this schnauzer and I connected up real early on, and so now he sings to me. So it's very nice.
Wow. I don't really have a few dogs, but none of them sing. But to the audience, since most of the audience, I'm thinking, doesn't have singing dogs, what if your dog, ladies and gentlemen, could greet you with more than a growl or announce the reason he's scratching at the door? It sounds absurd, and much like the storyline from the Pixar film Up, but Scandinavian scientists are working to develop a headset that could soon allow your furry friend to speak his mind. The Nordic Society for Invention and Discovery is the brains behind, and this is what it's called, No More Woof, W-O-O-F, technology that aims to distinguish canine thought patterns and then issue them as short sentences via a microphone. I'll show you guys a picture of this thing in a minute, but the brain waves differ quite a lot from different races as well as individual dogs. However, it is possible to detect some common patterns, and we have no doubt in the future this technology will open up a vast new era of communication between dogs and humans, or animals in general and humans. The research team who previously brought the world such inventions as the pet flying carpet, and I don't know what that is, weren't immediately available for comment today. And guys, I'm reading this off of ABC News. This is off, you know, this is not one of those other websites. This is ABC, whatever that's worth. Explained the most recent project on their website, No More Woof is the result of combining the latest technologies in three different areas. EEG. You've heard it said by your doctor, go get an EEG. It's kind of like an EKG, except instead of looking at your heart, it's looking at the waves in your brain. So
they can't pronounce it either, so don't feel bad.
Yeah, they can't pronounce it either. Microcomputing and special software. Those are the three things. Now, the operating system relies on sensors in the headset, which detect electric signals in the dog's brain waves. Technology from an inbuilt processing device then analyzes the signal patterns and deciphers them into distinct feelings like anger, curiosity, or tiredness. Sample sentences such as, I'm hungry, but I don't like that, or I'm curious who that is, will be programmed into the device and emitted through a loudspeaker. English translations will be available along with French and Spanish headsets. How exactly scientists will attach the sensors to the dog's brain has yet to be ironed out. Issues like this, as well as the ethical and social concerns, are the reason why there's a whole lot more research to be done before the technology becomes available. The headsets are available, however, for pre-purchase on Indiegogo as part of the research funding campaign, with three different versions that range in functionality and price from $65 for the micro to $300 for the standard, all the way up to $1,200 for the superior customizable mini speaker replete with engraved dog tag. You might have to wait a while for the first prototype to arrive in the mail, but the implications are enormous, the researchers say. And as friendship is a two-way street, it's only fitting that the scientists are also aiming to develop a reverse headset for humans to bark their way into the hearts of their canine buddies. Other applications and accessories the researchers have in their far-sighted future include a Pavlovian training kit with original instructions by the psychologist Ivan Pavlov, to further the owner-pet bond through the use of play and classical conditioning. Right now, we're only scraping the surface of possibilities. The first version will be quite rudimentary, but hey, the first computer was pretty crappy too. So, this is not a joke, guys. Let me just see if I can show you a picture really quick. Let me grab a tab. ABC, talking dog device. There it is, right there. Talking device. Soon to hit market. ABC, I told you. This, now, you know, I don't know if you've ever done something cruel to your dog, like tied a helium balloon to his collar. They don't like that, and you shouldn't do that. But it is funny for a minute, and then stop it. But when this, when the dog thinks something, and this thing starts talking, now that's got to freak the dog out. Wouldn't you agree, David?
Probably. What would freak me out is coming home and seeing my dog at some point with Rosetta Stone for Dogs, where he's teaching him new languages. Go ahead.
I'm trying to make this doggone advertisement go off. Okay, I killed the bot. Okay, you guys couldn't hear it, but it was...
I asked my dog the other day what his favorite city was, and he said New Yorkie. A little humor there. Right, work with me. I'm just coming up with this stuff.
Oh, that's pretty good. Yeah, yeah. Right. You fly by the seat of your pants. I understand. So, guys, you got... let me refresh the page and see if you can just see the device one more time. It really looks... Yeah, right there. See it? That's just bizarre. But go to Indiegogo.com. You can... To help them create this, they need some money for their research and development, but by paying $69, you can get the minimum level, not the premium job, but the entry level, I guess, for $69, and it may be a while before you actually get it, but they'll take your $69, it'll go into research and development, and then bingo bango, you'll be talking to your dog. This is Tesla I just brought up, $258 today, or at the moment. The high of the day has been all the way up to
265.
That's a big deal.
It's a big deal. This makes analysts now will be adjusting their outlook for the stock to certainly into the 300s. And before you know it, you know, we'll have a stock that has moved up 10 times its value when it was, you know, back in 2012. That's a pretty big move.
10 times. Guys, any of you who trade in equities, I mean, a lot of the folks on this show were specialists in futures and, you know, maybe a lot of option people too. But what they call a 10-bagger in stocks, that's a big deal. So that can be a stock that goes from 10 cents to a dollar, or a dollar to $10, or $10 to $100. You only need a couple of those in your lifetime that you're able to buy enough of, obviously, to put you on Easy Street. I keep looking for that street. They keep
some
telling
city
it's just
has
up
a
ahead
street.
On the right. Yeah.
Some city has a street with Easy Street on it. Somebody's come up with that. We live on Easy Street. Yeah. Come on down. So that would be some nice area in San Diego or California or maybe somewhere, you know, in Texas. I don't know. But
all right. It says here that the Mt. Gox Bitcoin scandal is the best thing to happen to Bitcoin in years. It may take a giant scandal to make Bitcoin respectable. Bitcoins, the esoteric digital currency that enthusiasts believe will one day take over the world, may one day be used everywhere from supermarkets to 401k retirement plans, but right now it's in a temporary shambles. Bitcoins are traded by digitally savvy geeks on several exchanges the same way Wall Street traders use exchanges to make bets on the US dollar and the Japanese yen. Today, Bitcoin's biggest and most important exchange, known as Mt. Gox, just plain disappeared. And we've already talked about that. That was the big news yesterday. The scandal is this. 774,000 Bitcoins worth $409 million. And also, now, it's not just $409 million, but it also represents an outstanding percentage, a very decent outstanding percentage of all Bitcoins in existence.
What are they trading at today?
Gone missing. Gone missing.
Oh.
I don't know, David. Let's find out.
I'm curious. If this news is really bad for it.
Well, actually, they're saying the news is good.
I'd like to see where they're trading then, yeah. Either way.
Let's see. How much is one Bitcoin worth today? See the live Bitcoin price. One Bitcoin right now equals $581.
Okay, so it's up a bit. It was, I think they had moved down into the $300 or $400 range recently, but they're at 500 and something.
They have been as high as 1200.
Mm-hmm.
And
so they had a,
I do believe that our guest is with us.
Great.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure that we'd like to welcome back to CFRN Mr. Wayne Jett. He is the author of the book, The Fruits of Graft. Wayne, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Dwayne. Glad to be here with you.
Glad. I don't know if we can up that volume just a tad there. Do you have such a control, Bert? Bert's patching him in. Wayne, it might just be a matter of you just maybe just speaking up just a tad.
All right. I was speaking clearly, but
he sounds pretty good. He sounds
perfect.
Pretty good.
No, you sound perfect now. It could be that I might have had my headphone turned down a little bit. So, well, it's been a week since we spoke with you. How have you been?
Well, fine, I think. I'm eager to go ahead with our discussion this morning.
Okay.
It's certainly been interesting to me so far.
Well, you know what? Let's dive right into it. Let me just throw you one little thing. We don't have to talk about it today. We can talk about it next time. But the Bitcoin, I'd love to know your thoughts, if it's for real, if it's going to be around, the big blow-up of one of the exchanges. I know you already have stuff that we plan to talk about today. So if you want, we can save that for a future show, okay?
Well, I'll make a comment or two about it. I'll just say straightforwardly that I don't consider myself an authority about Bitcoin because, frankly, I haven't spent enough time on it to understand how they calculate the value, what basis gives it value, other than participation by various parties. I do know that a person or two that I have high regard for have participated in it from the standpoint of one being a major business that has begun using it or accepting it in their trade and business.
Talking about Overstock?
Yes.
Yeah, I know, Patrick.
But,
okay.
yes, but in regard to the currency itself, it obviously has developed from the fact that our current currency system is distrusted so highly,
mm-hmm.
and I think properly so. We have a very badly, not just mismanaged, but corruptly managed currency system, primarily the dollar. The dollar, of course, is the reserve currency for international trade, at least it has been. It's much less so now than it was even a few years ago because the manipulation of the dollar has been so bad. The situation in our international monetary system has simply been that there has been a race to the bottom led by the dollar. The Federal Reserve has been purposely devaluing the dollar very sharply since 2002, 2003. And in the circumstances of the dollar being the trade reserve currency, other economies, other currencies have to devalue along with the dollar, or they are unable to sell into the U.S. market. And of course, the U.S. market being the largest in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Any country such as Brazil or China or anyone else, if they don't devalue along with the dollar, all of a sudden their goods are too overpriced here. They won't sell, and their economy is hit by unemployment. So therefore, other currencies such as Japan, such as China, you go right down the line, they have mm-hmm. to and they do devalue their currencies, and so every currency in the world has been devaluing, it's just a very not just sad. I mean, it, as I said, is corrupt in my viewpoint, because in large part the Federal Reserve monetary policy in secret. It says some things in public which may or may not really reflect what its intentions are, and it claims to need secrecy in order to, otherwise it can't carry out its objectives. Well, I just don't buy that. I think it has corrupt and very destructive policies, and therefore that's why they remain confidential. Also, one more reason for the so-called secrecy or confidentiality of their actions is that insiders of the Fed greatly profit on that inside information in the stock market, in the foreign exchange markets for currencies, and they make untold billions of dollars by having that inside information.
Yeah, it was amazing here recently that Congress or the president, somebody, they said, okay, guys, you can't trade on that insider information anymore. We're going to officially just tell you not to do it. I mean, it was already illegal, but they had to just – how did that play out? Was it the president that signed something or Congress passed – David, do you remember?
Well, Congress.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. Congress had has for many, many years, and it's not a conspiracy. It's just that they were not under the same laws that ordinary people were. They had the inside information, and no one said to them, hey, you've got specialized inside information. You can't trade on that information. They did trade on that information for many years, and there was some irony to, and so it was rather humorous, Wayne, to see these people standing up applauding the passage of a bill that stopped them from doing what has been illegal for all of us for so many years, and stop them from so-called profiting from their inside information. It was really quite a scene.
Well, I agree with you on that, and I might say, though, that those insiders, the ones in Congress, are bit players. They're small fry compared to the real insiders, which are the people who sit on the boards of the various Federal Reserve banks, certainly those who sit on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. Those are the real insiders, and they keep the Fed's deliberations secret in order for them to have the advantage on everyone else. They know to a certainty what the Fed is going to do and when they're going to do it, and there's nothing at all that keeps them from going back to their companies, going back to their wherever they work, and utilizing the information that they have completely. And certainly nothing is done if and when they do those kind of things. It's just never acknowledged that that's exactly the circumstance they're in.
Right.
Wayne, you probably are a proponent to whatever degree of, as an example, Bitcoin, because Bitcoin is the antichrist to a centralized currency. It's a completely decentralized currency where no one person group has any control over it. There's no bank that it has to be redeemed in. There's no central anything. That's one of the main tenets of the Bitcoin, is that it takes the power out of any one group's hands, and it decentralizes the currency and anonymizes, if there's such a word, the currency.
As I say, and I honestly say it, I haven't studied Bitcoin enough to know whether I can fully agree with you, and I might wind up agreeing with you.
Well, yeah, essentially I think you would in the end, because it is actually taking the power player possibility out of the currency. The people that designed Bitcoin designed it with in mind that there wouldn't be a central anything that it's completely decentralized and anonymous, so that there really is no central person that commands the price going up or down and so on. And I think in the end that would probably, now there may later be conspiracies about, I'm sure there, in fact, let me predict, actually, that there will be a conspiracy theory about Bitcoin, but it is a completely decentralized currency that does not have a central power source, a place that verifies anything with it except for the Bitcoin mining, which is a mathematical equation.
I certainly can relate to and see the desirability of the anonymity in terms of no central control. However, here's the problem that I see, the primary one in terms of what a currency is supposed to do. A currency's primary role is to be a stable store of value, one that does not either increase or decrease in value. That is what you need in order to have the economy operate at its full potential, at its maximum prosperity and growth rate. If a currency goes up in value, which certainly Bitcoin has been applauded for doing, it simply is grossly detrimental to the prosperity of the economy. What you need to have, as I said, the primary principle of classical economics, the stable monetary value. If, for example, your currency goes up in value, it is extremely destructive to the general business of the economy, because every person in the economy must immediately reduce their prices of their goods and services, or they will not sell. That is why deflation is regarded as so detrimental.
Mm-hmm.
For example, let me just give you the example that comes from history. The longest depression that the United States has ever had in terms of a continuous contraction in the economy was not depression of the 1930s. It was the 1870s. And it was a deflationary depression caused by an act of Congress after the Civil War. During the Civil War, I'd have to say, Lincoln printed greenbacks as the way of financing the war. That was...
That's where that term came from, greenbacks, yeah.
That is right. And as a result, we had about 50% inflation of the dollar's value. It lost about 50% of its value during because of that printing of paper money. There was a great pressure immediately after the war to get rid of the greenbacks and to go back to the same value for the dollar as before the war, which was $20.67 per ounce of gold. There was fighting back and forth about what to do during the rest of the 60s. In 1873, Congress finally passed a law that said, okay, we're going back to $20.67 in, I think it was January of 1879. Now, by the time they did that, the dollar had already gained value because of the political pressure for doing that, and so it was not the entire 50% inflation that was still to be wrung out of the dollar. But nevertheless, it had at least 25 to 30% inflation that had to be wrung out of it, and so the dollar steadily increased in value from 1873 to 1879. Now, that was a period in which the economy was supposedly going gangbusters, and yet there were bankruptcies throughout that period of time all over the country, because everyone was having to sell their product at a lower price than it cost to produce them.
Yeah, that doesn't work for very long.
No, it doesn't. Everybody was producing themselves right out of business. And there's a lengthy discussion of that by Milton Friedman in his 1960 book, U.S. Monetary History. I discuss it in my book also, and I point out the things that, for one reason or another, Milton Friedman didn't point out and didn't discuss in his, that in fact, even though there was a so-called boom economy, it was in fact an economy that was just wrecking businesses all over the place, and it was because of that deflation.
Deflation, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I've just got to say that whether it's inflation or deflation, either of them is a deterioration in the quality of the dollar, of the currency. And this is exactly the stock and trade of how the Federal Reserve since 1971 has been able to use that power to create instability in the dollar so that it manipulates the stock markets, the foreign exchange markets. There are untold trillions of dollars, in effect, looted out of through the markets by the insiders who know what the Fed is actually doing. For example, one of the things I show in my book, you know, the whole thing, the rhetoric that comes out of the Fed is that they stabilize the dollar's value, or they control the dollar's value, they regulate the economy by changing the interest rate, the overnight rate for the federal funds for bank lending. That is not what they do. That is a diversionary theory, a tactic that they use to justify manipulating that interest rate. But that interest rate is simply a way of the major banks who own the Fed are able to set their lending rates on an antitrust violation basis. I mean, that's what it ought to be, but it's not because the Fed does it. They set that overnight rate, and then all of the banks, at least all of the big ones, set their prime rate of lending three points above the overnight rate.
Right.
And so, for example, now it's at 0.25%, so all of the prime rates are 3.25%. And then the lending rates are above that, whatever it is. Well, that's just a way of violating the antitrust rules without doing it. The Fed does it for the big banks. And so it takes the competitiveness out of the banking business.
My big gripe with this whole economic turnaround that we've been trying to mastermind and pull off, people who, businessmen with great ideas, products they wanted to bring to market, they, you know, supposedly we're flooding the banks with all this cash so that we can stimulate the economy. But yet, a year ago, if you walked into a bank and tried to get a loan for anything, they just kind of laughed at you. Because why in the world would they want to do something risky like loan you money when they can just leave their money locked up safe overnight and draw interest on it? I believe my theory, and I'm no economist, is that they should have been penalized instead of being, you know, given a bonus for not lending the money, the overnight rate. They should have been penalized, should have been charged a penalty for every dollar that they did not put into circulation, because that was taxpayer money, and it should have gone back to the taxpayers through the vehicle of a business loan. That would have created jobs. That would have got this country back on its feet the right way without putting us trillions of dollars further in debt.
Well, Dwayne, you also don't want to go. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dwayne.
You're certainly on the right track. I would adjust a little bit what you're saying there. It was actually worse than that. It's not just a matter of, the Fed misjudged here, or this is a closely planned activity. It wasn't just that they were paying the banks a quarter of a percent annual interest rate in order to have their money in reserves. Frankly, the banks would make a lot more money if they were lending and making 2 or 3% on the dollar and instead of a quarter percent.
Yeah, but there's barely risk involved with that.
Yeah, but the thing is that, of course, I objected, and I wrote about it at the time. They never should have paid any interest for holding reserves, because reserves, by definition, are not invested. They are to be reserves only, and they can't be earning money. So how can the Fed be paying them a quarter of a percent?
Good question.
It only comes out of the devaluation of the dollar, the inflation that they're introducing into the system. The reason they're doing it, though, and the reason you were right on the point, that you go out and ask for a bank loan and they look at you like you're from another planet, is because particularly the smaller banks, the regional banks, the community banks, have learned the hard lesson since 2008. The message from the regulators is, you make loans, we're going to come in and shut you down on Friday night, and you'll belong to somebody else on Monday morning. We're going to say that you are have a stressed balance sheet, and you'll never have a way of protesting it. You will belong to someone else at no cost, and your shareholders will lose every penny they've got. That is
now, Wayne, if I can interject something here. If I can interject something here, the fact is, though, that millions of loans have been made through that time period. Millions of homes have been sold to people, or however, whatever the number is. There's been a large number of loans that actually have been made. To listen to what you just said or to what Dwayne said, it would seem like no loans have been made. But the fact is that every single day in America from 08 on through now, loans have been made to people either buying homes and so on. Now, your credit has to be very good, and you have to be as good as gold and so on, but there's no question that loans have been made. It's not as if nothing's happened.
Where have those loans been coming from? They've been coming from the large banks. They've been coming from the fact that the J.P. Morgan Chase has gone coast to coast. They're all over California now. The big banks that own the Fed, since 2008, I saw just the other day, they have increased their assets by over 37% since 2008. Now, they were already monstrous in size compared to the rest of the industry, and now they're 37% more in, 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
That is what has been going on. Has been a roll-up of the smaller bank competition, a roll-up of the community banks that serve Main Street, and the banks that have been lending have been the major banks to which the money from the Fed has been flowing, allowing them to consolidate their power and to become even too bigger to fail.
Right.
And also above prosecution.
Oh, yeah, they're also too big to jail. That's right. Yeah, you said it.
Yeah.
You said a lot right there,
and you have,
for sure.
You have just in the last few weeks announced yet another multi-billion dollar settlement by J.P. Morgan Chase of prosecution charges that have never even been leveled, trying to make a settlement outside the court system, simply with the prosecuting attorneys that we won't prosecute you if you'll give us $13 billion. I think it was $13 billion that they agreed to pay. When they're willing to pay $13 billion for just, well, we're not going to file charges, and we don't even know what the violations were, this is a very, very, very sick system.
Yeah, now, that's a huge red flag.
Do you believe... go ahead. Oh, go ahead, Dwayne. Do you believe that the housing crisis itself was planned or was
orchestrated?
I am quite certain it was. I've spelled that out in quite a lot of detail in my book. and also exactly how the mortgage industry was destroyed. The private mortgage industry was destroyed in large part by market manipulation.
Who did that benefit? Who did the crowding, this whole crash that wiped out so many homes, equities, and so on, who benefited from that, and why would they want the powers to be, the elite or whoever, why would they want to send, let's say they had this control to do this, and you're stating that they did, and that they planned it, I suppose, and did it. Why would they do that?
Well, there were a large number of relatively small, it was a dispersed industry, the private mortgage industry, and those companies essentially have been wiped out. And we'll see as things move along that essentially the big Wall Street players are going to wind up owning the industry. It's hard to tell right now, but one of the major objectives, I believe right along, and I've written about it a number of times, since 2008, the Wall Street players have wanted to get their hands on the mortgages that were so-called worthless and toxic at the time these major banks like Lehman and Bear Stearns and a number of others were taken down. Those so-called toxic assets, I said in my book and also since then, many of them, most of them, the great majority were not toxic at all. That was a ruse that was developed through the major media to make it appear that was the case. There were several factors that were put together to make it all come down at the same time. It was like a planned demolition.
Now, Wayne, I personally know across the street from me, where I live, a fellow who was, he did not have proper documentation to even be in the United States. He bought a $350,000 home. He put no money down. He never made a single payment. He lived there for 6 months to a year before they finally threw him out. And we all know of instances where the bag boy down at Safeway, who was making, you know, $8 an hour, okay, an honest day's work for an honest day's pay, blah, blah, but he's going out and buying a $500,000 home. That math's wrong. It doesn't work. And I think that's what David's referring to is, I mean, this really did happen. I mean, people really did buy homes they could not afford, and we know that the president, the administration, the current administration, when they relaxed those standards for loans, which allowed, if you could fog a mirror, practically, you know, you could get a loan. That's where it all went south. So, I mean, what's your take on that?
Well, no doubt that happened to a certain extent. To the extent that it happened, it was such a small part of even the mortgage business that it would not at all have justified the kind of complete destruction that swept through the industry and wiped it out. And what was actually going on, discuss this in specific terms in my book. I relate a hedge fund manager who had described his circumstance. They had hit upon, this has actually been orchestrated, and he finally, the word finally got around to him about what was going to occur. He said it finally occurred to him that his problem was, in terms of making a real killing in the destruction of the mortgage industry, that is, he was short selling it. He was naked short selling it, and he wanted to make his bundle on the crash. And he said, in so many terms, to a noted journalist who reported it, that his problem was there just were not enough, and he used a profane term, I'll say crappy loans. And therefore, he finally hit upon the fact that they knew how to make them bad, no matter what. And they knew how to make as many bad loans as they wanted. And here's the way they did it. They basically used what is called a credit default swap. They would find bad loans, and then they would multiply the number of bad loans as many times as they wanted by simply buying that number of credit default swaps on the bad loan. That's the way they put together a number of the mortgage-backed securities, in which they put nothing but bad loans in it and multiplied them many times over. They're called the synthetic loan.
Derivative, yeah.
Because they were simply having mirror images of bad loans made by the use of credit default swaps, which basically is just something that says, I promise to pay all of the amounts due if that loan goes bad. That's what a credit default swap amounts to. And they put a bunch of those in on bad loans, and all of those blew up. They peddled them off to the institutions like Bear and Lehman by acting like they were perfectly good mortgage-backed securities. And then they knew those things were grenades that they could blow up and would blow up as soon as they got into the hold of those big banks.
And the guys that sold them short made trillions of dollars. So
that's correct.
That's
and,
true.
There were a number of other aspects that they made to make it work. For example, they set up a London-based mortgage-backed security index of those kind of mortgage-backed securities. It's called the ABX index, and it was a highly superficial index, in which you could actually identify the specific mortgage-backed securities that were in it. And there were only something like 24. It was not broad scale across the whole asset class at all. But it was so easily manipulated. All you had to do in order to make that index go down is simply buy or sell those mortgage-backed securities short, or buy credit default swaps on them, and they would automatically go down. And that's exactly what happened. That index, ABX, went into effect in, I think it was March of 2007. And by April or May, it was already starting in a nosedive, supposedly, and it was being reported through the financial media as, oh my goodness, it looks like mortgage-backed securities may be having some headwinds. And, of course, they also, at the same time, adopted a rule of accounting through the FASB, Financial Accounting Standards Board. They adopted a rule of accounting called mark-to-market that had been outlawed in 1938 after it had been misused and abused during the Great Depression to make assets go down then.
Now, Clinton brought that back in, right?
Supposedly, mark-to-market has been done away with, but mark-to-market, that was actually adopted by the FASB, which is not Congress. It's not a law. It's the accounting board. And it was basically pushed through there by the same kind of powerful influences that we know about. And with that ABX index and with the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, Sarbanes-Oxley basically made accounting firms liable and also executives liable that if they didn't report accurately, they could go to prison.
Oh,
so they were trying to.
Small cap companies couldn't even afford their accounting bill anymore, much less research and development. That was a
right.
crime against humanity. Sarbanes-Oxley.
Yeah.
I want to jump back to we left. Wayne, can I take us back to where we left off last week? Can we do that? And I know David's got some questions for you, too. Last week, right where we ended, you had told us that the most significant and destructive thing, in your opinion, that Franklin Roosevelt did to cause the Great Depression. Let's kind of bring the audience up to speed, anybody that wasn't here. What was that big thing? How did it affect the economy here in the U.S., and around the world, and then I want to go to David for his questions, whatever he might have. Take us back to that discussion on Roosevelt. What did he do to cause the Great Depression?
As I said, there were about 10 to a dozen significant things, all of which were highly destructive, that were just designed to make things, make people poorer and hungrier. But the big thing that I told you is that between 1933, when he was elected and got into office, and 1940, those first two terms that Roosevelt served, he used tax revenues, and he raised taxes every year that except one. Congress wouldn't allow him to raise in 1939, but he used those tax revenues to buy gold on foreign exchange. And he bought all of the gold production in the U.S. as well. Now, between including the gold confiscation, everybody had to turn in their gold, and he bought all of that at $20.67 an ounce, and then immediately devalued the dollars that he had paid for it to $35 an ounce. That's a 41% loss for the people who turned in their gold. He started buying the gold. And the important thing that he did with the gold is that he was taking it out of the monetary system. We were supposedly still under the gold standard for most of the time that he was in office. And yet he was deliberately buying 1,000 tons of gold and taking it out of the gold standard system so that it would shrink the amount of currency in the world. And specifically, the country that was hurt the most was the United States. We stayed on the gold standard. Others, and let me just say that between 33 and 40, he bought 13,185.3 metric tons of gold, taking it out of the monetary system. That was more gold than every other country in the world owned in 1930. So the other countries of the world, with the Depression hitting, they sold their gold in order to feed their people.
Okay.
We bought it and took it out of the monetary system, shrank the number of dollars in the private economy just unimaginably, and starved our people to death. That is, more than anything else, number one, it caused the Great Depression. And number two, it destroyed the gold standard that had been, and still is by some observers, it had been one of the most ingenious things to spread prosperity that had ever been invented by the mind of man. And yet it's still derided today as if it caused the Great Depression. It was Roosevelt's destruction of the gold standard that caused the Depression more than anything else.
David,
I pause and give you a chance to get a word
in. Yeah, David, come on. What kind of questions you got here?
Well, if we could switch back to the housing, I suppose that if the crash was, you know, part of the planned move for them, but for the elite or whoever to profit from it, that almost predisposes and means that the run-up itself, and I'm wondering if the run-up in housing was also something that you see as purposefully done, manipulated, controlled by the group.
Well, let me just say that the so-called run-up in housing is uniformly, practically attributed to the expansion or the devaluation of the dollar or the amount of money that the Fed was printing back in 2003, 2004, 2005. Well, let me tell you, during those years, through 2005, 2006, 2007, most the Fed created in new money in any one year was $40 billion. Okay. And that was not the average, that was the max.
Okay.
In fact, and that was at a time, they only started expanding, when we had tax cuts and our economy started growing at 4, 5, 6, 7% growth. And so if anything, that $40 billion a year was minimal, money creation compared to the amount of economic growth. So it was all a matter, again, of what the Fed is able to do in directing the money where it wants to go. And let me tell you how they did that. They again, they directed the money that they were creating, not to the small banks who loaned the Main Street. They were directing it primarily through the major international banks that loaned to the hedge funds and the financial speculators on Wall Street. And a good part of that was put out in the mortgage investments. And they're looking for more product to sell abroad. Those were the big international banks selling those products to international buyers and making money that way.
What about the tech boom? What about the tech boom and the tech bust? You know, and we've got the housing boom, the housing bust. I mean, we can go way back in time to the tulip boom and bust.
I'll be happy to describe that.
Are all those controlled situations? Is that what you're saying? Is that what's in your book?
That one was a combination of both. It was initiated about what the Federal Reserve did. Not by inflating the dollar, but by the reverse. Between 1996 and 1999, the Fed deflated the dollar secretly. It never mentioned all that time deflation as a problem, because deflation is what they were purposely doing. And let me
tell
you
how they do that. Go ahead. I'm just asking, how do they do that? How do they deflate the dollar without us knowing secretly? I think you're going to explain that, so go ahead.
They were not divulging during those years how many dollars they were creating. And they weren't creating enough dollars, particularly after 1997.
Okay, if you can hold on 1 second. There used to be a number called the M3, the money supply, right? Isn't that where we were told how much money there was? And then somebody... He took that away. No longer we knew what that number was, right?
Well, yes, but...
I'm not an economist, so you got to bear with me here, because some of this stuff is above my pay grade. Yeah. So go ahead.
M3 was never a measure that was particularly informative to me. The number that I use in looking at what the Fed is doing is the monetary base. The monetary base are the number of dollars that the Federal Reserve actually creates and puts out into the economy. The Fed is the only one that can create those, although once those get into the economy, the banks can then will get them as deposits. And based on those deposits, they can ordinarily lend, say, $10 for everyone they get into a deposit.
Right.
So that expands that way. But here's what, this is very important about that tech crash. Between 1996 and 1999, the Federal Reserve increased the value of the dollar, the purchasing power of the dollar, by nearly 50%, between 40 and 50%. That's a very severe deflation. Even more stringent than the one I described to you earlier that happened in the 1970s because of Congress. Now, the way I know that is that the price of gold, which had been stable ever since the crash of 87,
right?
It was stable at more or less 350, and it got to $400 an ounce,
right?
In the early 90s. In 96, it was about between 400 and 425. By By 1999, it was down to $252 an ounce. That does not mean that gold is volatile in price, in value. The whole thing about gold is that it doesn't change. It doesn't rust. It doesn't canker. It doesn't get used up. It's always there, and it's always the same.
Mm-hmm.
So its value is always the same. That's why it gives us an accurate reading of how our currency is valued.
Yeah.
When it takes more dollars to buy an ounce, it means the dollar is worth that much less.
Okay, but this business of the Fed deflating the dollar, by what mechanism did they do this? I'm sure that's a question David has to have. How did they do that?
In order for the dollar's value to stay the same, the Fed's proper conduct would be you create the same number of dollars, new dollars, as the amount of new products and services that are created by working people in the country. If you don't do that, and the value of products and services increases, then every dollar buys more and more of them because there are no more dollars. You have to keep up with the amount of goods and services produced by your working people in order for the money to keep its stable value. And so the dollar, the Federal Reserve's proper function is to monitor that economic growth and keep the number of dollars increasing so that the value of each dollar is stable. Now, there's a very easy way to do that, and I discussed it at some length in monetary theory in my book. All you have to do is target the price of gold. If you target the price of gold, and every time the price of gold, for example, goes above $400.
Yeah.
Sell a few treasury bonds and soak up a few dollars, and that will bring the price right back down to $400 an ounce. And if it falls below $400 an ounce, you add some dollars, and it'll go right back to $400 an ounce. That's all you have to do. Very simple mechanism, very simple target, and the price and the value of the dollar would remain the same all the time. And you let the market decide how many dollars it needs in order to do that. A very easy mechanism, but by increasing the value of the dollar by nearly 50% between 1996 and 1999, the smaller economies of the world experienced it first, and that caused for example, the Southeast Asian tigers. All of which used dollars, those economies crashed and went bankrupt. And what it was, the way it was reflected in the U.S. economy is that all of the businesses whose products are commodities and are priced on spot markets, those prices get adjusted daily. And so those people lose money first. And when the prices of their commodity products start going down, that means their stock prices go down, capital's withdrawn from them, and it's moved to other places. That happened in the U.S. economy because of that deflation. They started moving capital out of the commodity major industries and into, finally, it all moved into high tech. Because they were still profitable, supposedly everybody else was losing money, and it drove the tech prices very high. And then they simply reversed the field and blew those companies to smithereens, primarily with fraudulent trading in the stock market. That's the tech price moved too high because if capital had been arrayed across the entire spread of industries, you wouldn't have had tech prices nearly as high. But nevertheless, here's what happened. And again, I give the details of this in my book, The Fruits of Graft. The crash, the tech crash began in March of 2000. I think March 7th, something like that. And it was exactly at that time we learned in 2007 that was the exact time that Goldman Sachs, for the first time that we know about, they notified their hedge fund clients that all of their clients could use the trading platforms directly without going through a Goldman Sachs trader or broker. They could simply go directly to the trading platforms and record their own transactions. And as soon as that was permitted, the hedge funds started coming in. And at that time, it's important to note, we had what was called the uptick rule of the Securities and Exchange Commission. The uptick rule said you cannot sell short unless the previous trade was an uptick, that is, a buy instead of a sale. I'm sure you remember that.
Yeah. I remember that very much. Wayne, I want to make room for David to have an opportunity here to ask some questions, but I also want to ask you a question from one of our listeners. He has repeated this many times on this radio program as part of the audience. He's typed this in. I want to run it by you, but I do want David to have an opportunity here to ask some questions. This is from Michael, who I believe was in banking at some point in time. This is what Michael has typed this in, gosh, I don't know how many times, but the biggest hoax or myth is that banks lend out depositors money. In the history of banking, they never lent out $1 of depositors' money. It is illegal for them to do so, so learn first where the money comes from. Any loan that is initiated is brand new money that did not exist before. Now someone has to pay the interest on that loan, but money is never created to cover that interest cost, so the money supply is eaten up by the interest cost, which drains the money supply in circulation. The bigger the debt, the more interest has to be paid. My 10-year-old daughter understands that, so what is the problem with other people understanding that? People have their head in the sand. Everybody needs to wake up. Now, you yourself just said earlier, Wayne, that if we go deposit $1 at the bank is then allowed to loan out like $10, right, based on the $1 we deposited. Is that
right.
Correct? But
yes.
Yet he's saying that that whole thing is a hoax and it's not true. And help me here.
I would just say that whether you call it lending out the deposits or whatever you call it, the banks
yeah.
are permitted
mm-hmm.
To create money in the same way that the Fed does, to the extent that if someone borrows money from them, they simply transmit, say you borrow $100 million.
Yeah.
They simply transmit into your account the numbers $100 million. And your bank will honor that as a loan from their bank. And therefore, they have created $100 million by that loan. Now, you can say that that is not making the same, lending the same dollars as the $10 million in deposits that you have to have in order to make that loan. But nevertheless, it is a creation of $100 million, and it puts it into the economy. And yes, they earn interest on that $100 million when they just have to pay interest on the $10 million that's deposited with them at a lower rate. So yes, that's the way they make money. But all of that is, in my estimation, in large part, is a game of chasing the tail, because what really happens in the economy, and the way there is so much power concentrated in what the Federal Reserve is authorized to do, that the rest of it is simply a game. They have tremendous power over those banks, and can determine this is simply black and white fact. They can determine whether a bank survives and exists or not. one way or another in terms of the regulatory power they have over them. I need to take just another minute, if I may.
Okay.
I didn't quite finish the important point of what I was saying about the tech crash.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Those hedge funds that started marking their own tickets, started marking short sales as long sales. They started doing that in March of 2000, the time exactly when the tech crash started, and they continued doing that all the way through October of 2002 when it ended. That entire period of time, those hedge funds, clients of Goldman Sachs, were permitted to mismark their trades, concealing short sales and concealing naked short sales. That's counterfeiting stock. So they were counterfeiting stock to sell and take the money and crash those stock prices of all the tech stocks and any other thing that was in the market at the time. They were permitted to do that, and we learned about that only in 2007. When we finally found out that the SEC had, in effect, the largest stock fraud investigation in its history underway against Goldman Sachs. And they settled that for, I think, $2 to $3 million, not against the hedge funds for all of the criminal looting that they were doing. They settled that against Goldman Sachs. Never brought any charges against the hedge fund, so far as I have been able to tell. And they settled that for $2.5 million or thereabout. And never even mentioned, the fact that naked short selling was going on or that they were crashing, the market. All of that, investigation of that was going on at the time that the CEO of Goldman Sachs, Henry Paulson, was nominated as the Secretary of the Treasury in May of 2006, confirmed practically unanimously by the Senate in July of 2006, and then came into Washington as a billionaire and presided over all of the financial destruction that I believe that he actually quarterbacked the financial destruction that went on in 2008, 2009, Well, he went out of office in 2000.
If you made a movie that explained, if you made a movie that portrayed everything that you just said right there, nobody would believe it. They would say that is science fiction. That's not possible. But no, it happened, folks, right here in America. It happened. We were sold a bill of goods, and we're still paying for it. And our children will be paying for it. David, do you have any questions? Because we're up against a hard time constraint here.
Probably no, not right now. Maybe as a general question,
sure.
Take one out of me. But Wayne, you've mentioned on your previous times that you were on the program here that, you know, the elite of the country do have the power. They are able to control markets. They're able to control businesses. They sort of, apparently, they hovered over the last two centuries of economic development, and they have many different operations that they do. They have more. From what you said, they have more money than any of the biggest players in the last 200 years. As those periods developed, the Rockefellers and the U.S. Steels and the whatevers, now up to today's, you know, Googles and Apples and so on. By the way, Apple has more money in the bank than the U.S. government. Just as a side note. But if that is the case, why are the elite, and if they can destroy people that go against them and don't play with them, why are they going to allow you to write a 600-page book exposing all of the facts of their operations throughout this time?
That's a fair question. Yes, it is.
You know, how do you put that?
I would say because they are so able to control our media, to control conversations, to make sure that books of the kind that I have written simply don't get read, don't get heard about, don't get discussed at all on television programs. and all the other kinds of distractions that people have, very few people have read my book in terms of the total picture of things. There have been a few sales in other countries, but the exposure here in the United States has been minimal. Even the few major radio stations who had me on, it's been minimal. And so people simply haven't heard about it. If you look at the Amazon comments on Amazon for the sales of my book, the few that are there from the readers who've written, most people keep their head down. Some people are very forthright, and they say that it's the best book they've ever read. They say that they learn more in one page than most books. They say that they got their money's worth in the first chapter, but it is very, very difficult to get that out in public when you're not saying and reporting what the so-called mainstream insists that you report. There is a very effective censorship in this country. The major publishers are owned by the people that I call the ruling elite. If they are not directly owned, they can be owned by them the next morning if they get out of line, and they know that. That's true of the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles, go right on down the line. They do not get out of line, and the people who work for them toe the line if they want to keep their jobs. It's very effectively enforced.
And, one other question. Go ahead. Finish up, Wayne. I want to interrupt you. Please.
Well, I've just got to say that, I'll tell you the truth. I've missed my point now.
So okay. No problem. My issue with a lot of this is that many conspiracy, you know, the calling card for the great conspiracy theory is that there's an omnipotence in a group of some kind that never goes away. In your own narrative, we have a group that has, you know, floated over the U.S. economy for two centuries, has controlled and pulled the strings on huge events that have taken place, almost as if life isn't big enough to produce its own events. It needs this group to produce those events. And I would say to you that obviously you're very bright and you have you've really accumulated a lot of facts about various things that have taken place. But, you know, a company like Apple that has more actual money than the U.S. government, and they have that money because they've got the brightest minds on the planet, the best marketing people, the best products. Take another company like Google. They have billions of dollars as well. Take three companies, you know, Apple, Google, and Samsung. If I came to you and said, does this ruling elite have more than they do? And if you say to me, well, yes, they do, and you effectively have said that, my question is since it takes these companies such enormous manpower to produce this kind of income, what is this small group of elite people doing to get their money, which totals more than perhaps any group of companies that I might bring to you? Therefore, they have more power over them.
What is the source of their income? Yeah. Very good question. I'd ask you just go to my website, classicalcapital.com, and read the piece that I just did this last week.
Okay.
Here's the way they get it. The Federal Reserve has given them a franchise to create the only money that's legal for use in this country and, in fact, in the world. And the money they create, they add no value whatsoever. They lend it to the government. They get interest paid on it, and they get the capital paid back to them, and the taxpayers have to pay it to them.
And what evidence do you have of that? How do you know that?
I give you my analysis as to exactly how that works. The paper they create...
I have that article up on the screen, guys. I've got it up on the screen for you, so you can go to Wayne's website and read this article. But Wayne, please go ahead. Finish your thought there.
They don't get value from thin air to put in those dollars. What happens when they create dollars is They are fungible. That is, they're interchangeable with every other dollar in the world. And so when they create $85 billion a month, as they did all through QE3, in order to buy things such as mortgage-backed securities, those dollars get a value in one way. They suck it out of the dollars that you've already worked for and earned. Every dollar in the world immediately has the same value. When they net back another 85, the value that those new dollars get comes out of your dollars, because you have that many more dollars now seeking the same total amount of goods and services. So every dollar is worth less, and their dollars are then created, and they lend them to the U.S. government, and they get a promise by the federal government to pay those back, obviously through taxes, and plus interest. And so in the final analysis, all of that money that the federal government owns is creating income for them, and also a total obligation to pay it all back plus the interest. Now, that is a way of forever getting tremendous trillions of dollars. The fact that we have $17 trillion paying interest to them, people say, any economist that's on the Fed dole, as practically all economists are, will tell you, oh, they give their extra money back to the Treasury every year, so it's just like all they do is just pay their cost of operation. Well, first, at the very least, they pay their owners a dividend every year, and they don't tell us how much those are. So they're earning dividends on dollars created out of thin air with the value provided only by the people who work for them out here in the real economy. And yet they are having wealth poured into their purses every day that central bank is in existence from people all over the world.
Hey, Wayne, can you come back? Can you come back next Wednesday? Can you do that?
Yes, I'll be glad to.
We're out of time. We're past our limit. But I enjoy this conversation. It's fascinating. I think we've only begun to scratch the surface here. And you've said on this show today that mainstream media, they're not picking up this book. They're not running with it. I just looked at some of the comments on the Amazon site, as you recommended, of people who have actually read the book. There are indeed some glowing comments there. I want to dig deeper into it myself. The book that you recommended last week that our listeners should read by H.G. Wells, Anticipations, I'm going to be honest, I had a difficult time reading that book because of the style in which it was written. But one of our listeners and a partner, CFRN partner, he read it cover to cover, and he made me some cliff notes because I haven't been able to get through it. Today he was talking about, or just now in the chat room, about irresponsible wealth. So there's just so much more to discuss, so much more to talk about. So if you're good with it, we'll see you back here next Wednesday, 1 p.m. Eastern. All right?
All right. I'll look forward to it.
I'll see you then.
Thanks for
All
having
right.
me.
Thank you, Wayne.
You're listening to CFRN, a community of believers who trade for a living. To learn more about who we are, what we do, and how we do it, call toll-free 1-866-928-3310, and we'll send you out a no-obligation information kit absolutely free. 866-928-3310.
All right. Well, there we go. Another hour in the can, as they say. David, do you still have time to go over some markets?
I do.
Okay.
Did I act well?
You were so well behaved. I was proud of you. No.
There you are.
I understand that you have some very strong beliefs, and he has some strong beliefs, and I just want to be a good referee and a good middleman, a good mediator here, because quite frankly, I'm caught in the crosshairs because so much of what he writes about and talks about, I believe with every bone in my body. Now, on the other side, some of the questions that you ask, see, I know that a lot of you don't think I'm the smartest guy in the world, but I got news for you. I have a double-digit IQ. Uh-huh, that's right. And so, with that double-digit IQ, I hear what you say, David, and the rational part of my mind goes, how in the heck is this even possible? But somewhere yet down deep inside, I believe that so much of it really is. And so that's why it fascinates me. And the fact that he has researched his side so well and documented it, and then you come in brash as a new day and say, wait a minute, that's crazy. But in a very nice way, I think that's just that's awesome. That's why they invented the radio.
There you are.
It wasn't from Led Zeppelin. This is
Led Zeppelin did a couple of good things. They had a couple of good things they did.
Yeah. Do you have charts you want to show?
No, okay. I will save them for tomorrow because we're only a few minutes into it here. But if you want, we can address a couple very very briefly
Whatever
here.
You want.
We have a few minutes left, but. The S&P, we've been in a pretty quiet day here. Nothing really has changed from our outlook. This 1844 level is very important at this point in the session because, and we've mentioned this to our group, that how the market handles 1844 late in the day will determine what the final move in the market for today will be. If we break 1844 and, you know, start to get below it, it's no big thing, but it would send prices back down to test the 1837, 1838 level. It's not a big, big move, but it, within the smaller context that we're in right now, that would be something to look at. This and many, many days, you know, the end of the day is very important, the end of the period and so on. So they're testing the 44 level right now. There's many other things going on in markets. All of them have many of them have some unusual things going on, movements and stuff. We'll go into the specific forecast and stuff, Duane, tomorrow because I'm running late here. But
sure.
I do want to say that it is interesting, and the one frustration that I have that perhaps is self-induced partially, but it's also partially on him is. This sounds like a lot of facts that he has conjectured secondarily into this narrative. This doesn't sound like facts being related to me. This sounds like this is my interpretation of facts, and now here's the narrative that, you know, that there's this elite and so on, all the stuff that he's talked about. Certainly, a lot of things go on behind the scenes. There's nobody is denying that. I think the thing that gets my hair getting up is when it is the Mona Lisa, when it is the great swaths of hundreds of years the same group has been in power, when in real life groups come into power and go out of power, that we see that all around us. But this one group stays in power, and even though they're psychopaths by his own words, they're bright enough to stay on top of the brightest minds in the world at that time. And we have some very, very, very bright people that are running very big corporations and companies that I just find it difficult to believe in a non-dreamlike state that they're picking up the phone and saying, yes, sir, no, sir, I'll get it done right away, sir. I just don't see Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I don't think it plays out in that manner, but yet
maybe it doesn't.
I believe that it very much exists, but it's not as simple as, you know, some shadowy voice picking up a phone and telling Elon Musk what he's going to do or not do. I don't think that's – I think –
Or creating
powers,
Elon Musk.
I think these powers could – well, I'm going to – there is nobody more surprised about who the president of the United States of America is right now, right this minute, than Barack Obama.
Okay.
He wakes up every day and looks in the mirror and goes, holy crap, how did this happen? I'm the president of the United States of America. He's the Manchurian president. No, come on. Who was this guy? Who was he 8 years ago? He got a chance to speak at the Democratic Convention, and America fell in love, and grown men started getting chills going up and down their leg. And the next thing you know, this nobody is president. Oh, well, it's America. Anybody can become president. Huh. Any American can become president. But that's a whole other discussion. At least do this, David. Go to classicalcapital.com.
No, I'm going to read his work. Of course.
Read that article, the one he just wrote, The Ultimate Money-Making Fraud Machine. And, boy, we'll just tear right into that thing next Wednesday.
All right. Well, listen, right, I'll go. It was great to have him on again. And we'll I'll see you guys tomorrow.
Thanks, David. Thanks. See you tomorrow.
Okay. See you then. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. All right, guys, we still got a couple minutes here that we can talk about the markets. You say that's why you come to this radio program. Some of you anyway. Some of you want to hear about the politics. Some want to hear about the technology. Some want to hear about the religion. So whatever it is that you're here for today, if you have a comment or a question, there were a ton of comments that came in for me to attempt to scroll up through and read them all. That can't happen. It's just not possible. But if you have something that I am going to attempt to copy and paste the entire scroll so that later I can go through it and circle important points to bring up on next week's show, I am going to do my very best to make that happen. But if there's something on your mind right now that you think I'm capable of answering, again, I have my limitations. I have my pay grade. I did not go to college. I don't make any secret about that. If you know a successful one, that's what somebody in the chat room just said. I'm not sure. Oh, I see what you're saying. Why, yes, we do. Take the free trial. Anyway, so if you have a question right now, you want me to take a look at a market, break it down, whether it's, I don't want to put words in your mouth. If there's a market you want to know something about, now remember, last Friday the question was, can we take a look at soybeans? And we have had, out of that question on Friday, when we took that in-depth look at the beans, we've had some really excellent trades, and we've only scratched the surface of that because all we've dealt with so far is the upside of that discussion. All that downside, all that pullback, we have to actually go in and rework that because we now have higher highs in the beans, and so some of those downside numbers have to be adjusted. So I don't know that we want to go down that road today. We could possibly do that tomorrow. But let me just go to the chat box and see what's popping in there right now. Okay, now, Jim, that's a tough one. May lumber. Let me just start the conversation out by saying I don't trade lumber. I've put out one lumber tweet in the past 3 to 4 years simply because somebody asked me to. Whether it worked out or not, I'll say you can go out there and find it on the Twitter feed and see for yourself. But give me the symbol, and we'll bring up the chart. Can anybody in the audience who has the DT Pro platform, if you can give me the symbol for May lumber, we'll bring that chart up, and we'll see what we can find. Let me find a chart. I can use this chart right here to do it. I'm going to blow it out to a daily chart. And look at this. What a nice move on the daily chart. Oh, you're very welcome, Iris. I'm so glad. come on, guys, somebody give me a symbol for melee. I know some of you are looking. Oh, you know what? I can look it up myself. Hang on. I know how to do that. Just stand by. Let me go to help. Let me go to contract specs. It's going to open up a browser window. We're going to go to, this page seems to have changed since the last time I went there. Bert, you in the background by chance? Currencies, grains, indices, softs. There's lumber. So LBSH, okay. Let's go there. LBSH. Start with an L. LB. There it is, right there. Random length lumber. LBSH4. Now, do we know that, is it the March contract, or did you say the May contract? May. Okay, so we want to go with K, not H. K. One thing I will say about lumber real quick. Now, again, I don't trade lumber, but right before the housing bust, okay, right before, and whoever was controlling and orchestrating it, the price of lumber, okay, you could go and buy a futures contract of lumber for less than what it cost to actually produce the lumber. And, yes, lumber is produced. God grows trees. Man makes lumber out of those trees. And so you've got production costs to go from tree to 2x4. Right before the housing bust, right before everything fell off the edge of the earth, you knew something was up because a contract of lumber was selling for less than what it cost to produce it. Anytime you see those kind of anomalies in any market, anywhere, you should start to ask some questions, okay? All right, so we're on a daily chart, and back here it looks thin. It's one of those thinly traded markets. Let me show you just real quick. If we went LBSH4, it would look a little more fleshed out a little bit, see, because that contract's been traded for a while. But we're rolling into the new contract, LBSK4. And so that's the one we're going to take a look at. Maybe before I do that, let me just hit escape, cancel, insert a volume indicator right here. This is how we always know. This is just a good overall lesson. How do you know which contract you want to be trading? Okay. Here is the March contract, and today 221 contracts have been traded. So we can see the last few days there's been, you know, some declining volume here. And maybe this last little spurt is people exiting that thing. So we've got 221 showing today. Now let's go LBSK4. Let's see what kind of volume we have today. Oh, see that number jumped up to 390. So this is absolutely the contract we want to be. And now that we've already identified that, we can just take this off of our chart so we have plenty of real estate to work with. Okay, delete volume. Yes. All right. What do we got here? We got a high. Well, here's a low. And a high, and a low. So we've got a leg and a retracement, leg and a retracement, and now we have a range. Okay, this thing has just been going sideways for this tool. Okay, so we've got a range. The price is trading inside of. And somebody clue me in on what the per tick value is on lumber. Now, some of you might be wondering, hey, wait a minute. You just said that you don't trade lumber. How do you expect to read the chart? Well, reading the chart has nothing to do with whether I trade the lumber or not, because we're technical traders. You know, supply and demand, that's not a factor here. That factor has already been factored in by the technicals. You know, some huge forest burnt down, that's already factored in by the technicals. So with that said, that's how you do it. And we can see that today, on a daily chart, we have broken out of this range that we've been in. This range started back on January 28th. We put in a low, and then we put in the high on January 31st. And we went from the bottom of the range to the top, to the bottom, to the top, to the bottom, to the top, to the bottom, to the top, to the bottom. So right here, what we're seeing today, this is kind of a big deal. Okay. Now, if we close outside of the range, that's a big deal. I don't know if this market is still trading or not. I'll wait and see if I see any little tick over here. If we pop back inside of the range, even like tomorrow morning, okay, then we could see, I mean, this has been just like, you know, ping-ponging back and forth. 355 on the low side, 365 on the upside, so that's a $10 range. Jim says it's $11 per tick, and so let me bring up a DOM, okay. Now, current price, 351.60. So let's go down here and look at 351.60. 70, 80, 90, 352. So there's 10 ticks per dollar. So from 355 to 360, there's going to be 50 ticks. And so, from 55 to 65, that's 10 times 10. That's 100 ticks. Correct me if I'm wrong, somebody. And so, 10 times 11 equals 110. So, each one of these moves has been worth $110 per contract. That seems a little light in the saddle. So, yeah, that's what I thought. Now, okay, Jim, you threw me off on math yesterday, but I think today you really are right, okay? Jim says it's an $1,100 trip. Pete, will you run the math for me? Okay? And yes, Pete says this is traded with the CME, okay? All right. So what do we do with this? Where do we go from here? Coming out of a range like this can be a little difficult. This low that's in place, we don't know if that's the low, okay? But we have to, for the moment, if we're going to do any type of analysis on this market, we have to accept the current low for what it is, and that is the current low. So we're going to do a reverse. We're going to grab our Fib tool. We're going to go from the swing high to the current swing low. Okay, obstacles overhead. If price were to start to rally from here, whether it's today, tonight, tomorrow morning, okay, whether it's this candle or the new candle that starts right here, if price starts to move up, the first obstacle it has to contend with is this bottom of the range. In the bottom of the range, as you can see, price action is a little jagged across there. So you have to keep in mind that it's, in this case, an area. Now, we could take the lowest point and we could define, okay, that's the exact bottom of the range. But if we want to embrace all of this movement back and forth, then we have to be a little more generous. That doesn't hurt our analysis in any kind of way. It just creates a little clearer picture for everyone, okay? It's just an area. That's all. We've been trading from this area down here to this area up here. And based on that math, $1,100 per move, per contract, not bad. You know, pretty nice. So, if we get through this obstacle, the bottom of the range, look where the 24% retracement is. To the naked eye, it looks like it's smack dab in the middle of the range. It is. If we accept 55 as the bottom and 65 as the top, then 360 is right in the middle. So, from where we are now, for any type of long activity, we got to get above this obstacle, and that puts us back inside of the range. And whenever we hit the extreme on a range, whether it's the upside of the range or the bottom side of the range, if the range holds, we then look for price to move back to the middle of the range. Once it gets to the middle of the range, it then becomes a 50-50 coin flip as to whether it's going to continue to the bottom of the range or reverse and go back up to the top. And I'm looking to see if I've got an example of that. This one went from the bottom to the top to the bottom. This one, it got beyond the, well, if you look at the, it actually did, and then to the bottom and then to the top. We haven't had a single one that reversed at the middle yet. Doesn't mean we can't or won't. We just haven't yet. So obstacles, 355. Next obstacle, 360. Next obstacle, 365. We can look at those as obstacles or opportunities. Okay. I'm going to write those because I'm going to change a few things here. So I'm going to write those numbers down. Okay, 355 is the bottom of the range, 365 top of the range, and then 360 is important because it's middle of the range and the 24% fib. That gives it a quality that's going to want to attract price to it. Okay? Now, moving on up the chart, at the top of the range, we also have the 38% retracement. Remember, we're looking at the entire move. We could look at just the last leg, and that would fine-tune it. And what I recommend that you do in your own time, we're going to go over the numbers for the entire move. I suggest that you, when we're done, break out your charts, break out your fib tool, and do the last leg down, which is going to be from this swing high to the same swing low that we're working on right now. What you're looking for are areas where you get overlap. Okay? Let's work our way up. 24. See how these are bunched together? Right here we've got a 50 and a 38. That's called confluence. So that makes the top of this range pretty important. And the top of the range straddles the 50 and the 62 of just the last leg down. Okay? But our chart will get very crowded very quickly. So we're just going to back out. I'll let you do that. That'll be your homework, okay? That'll give you a chance to get your hands dirty, roll up your sleeves, do some work. So now that we know those are relatively important numbers, let's do this. Let's go from this last leg down, okay? From that swing high right there, down to the swing low, and I'm going to open my chart up, and for this work, we don't need this, so we'll make it go away for now. Remove the slingshot. Yes, this gives us more real estate to work with on our desktop. We're going to really open this thing up, take a good look. Okay. So I've now, we've identified from the entire move down, we've identified a range. We also know where important fib areas are. We know where the middle of the range is. Based on just the last leg down, look at where the 62% retracement is. Okay? Middle of the range. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but let's go. I'm gonna do this, and then I'm gonna make it disappear again. Just want to check one thing. From the entire move, okay, 62 of just this last leg overlaps the 38 of the entire move, okay, and it's the middle of the range. So this is a hot spot right here. Okay, so we're going to get rid of these. So if price can break back above the bottom of the range, I'm going to suggest that price, it will have to get through these obstacles at 57 and 58, but I believe it's going to be drawn to this 360 middle. Okay. However, there's a lot of stuff here, a lot of noise, and so if I were actually going to put on a trade, a long trade, here's my window of opportunity. All this stuff down here, all this battling, okay? I don't want to be involved in that trench warfare. I want to be flying over in the Huey, really getting the lay of the land. Hey, we got troops over here. These are the buyers. We got troops over here. These are the sellers, okay? And think of these as trenches or foxholes, and boy, they try to run, and they get to the 38, you know? Okay, cover me. I'm going for the 50. Yeah. Cover me. I'm going, you know. Once those little skirmishes are over, then there's a lull in the action, okay? It's during that lull in the action that I want to swoop in, and I want to be long from about 360, 140. Let's see. See, I want to be above this swing high right here. And that swing high is 360.110. So give me 360.150. I'll take 360.150. Okay. That was too much. Let's bring it back down. How's that? Yeah, 360.150. I also want to be out before the high of this candle. The high of this candle is 364.60. We also know where the top of the range is. We know all of that. Okay, we got a lot of information. And so, from 361.50, consider being long to 363.50. I'll write that down. 361.50 to 363.50. Consider being long 361.50 to 363.50. You've gotten above the skirmish, okay? The trench warfare. And you've gotten up into this little area that just, you don't have any real obstacles in your way. What's the swing low of this candle? The swing low is 363.50 exactly. You might want to trim that upside target down a quarter. Okay. This is a $2 move. So if you shaved a quarter up here, or even 50 cents, still have a $1.50 move, okay? And there's 100, no, there's 10 ticks in a dollar. Hang on. Bring Don back up. In $1 from 352 to 353, there's 10 ticks. Not 100, 10. Okay? So, whatever it's worth, the move is good for $2, but on the safe side, make it a, you know, if I'm going to say it, then I might as well, I'll just put it there. I'm going to go 361.50 to 363. It's a $1.50 move. Okay. I'm going to take this, scoot it right back up. All right. So that's one consideration. Be long. May lumber. 361.50 to 363. What if we break out above 366? Well, that'll be kind of a big deal because the last time we did, we got slapped down hard, okay? Not saying there can't be more upside action. There may be. We always embrace all of the possibilities here. But for now, that gives us a long trade on the upside, okay? Well, what if price doesn't rally? What if now that we've broken out of that zone, what if we continue to fall? Okay, that's a fair question. Let's get an answer. The answer is always in the chart. It's built right in. We're going to go over here and we're going to grab our drawing tools. We're going to get our Fibonacci price extension. Now, as you know, I do not believe in Fibonacci as a standalone trading methodology. I attempted for a number of years. Oh, wait, I can't do this because we don't have a pullback. You know, to do a price projection from here. See, we would need a, we need a retracement. Okay. So, we're going to have to do this the hard way. But that's okay, because the answer is where? Always in the chart. So that's where we'll get our answer. All right, we're going to have to go from, go back to insert, drawing tools, price extension, swing high to the swing low. And then this little guy, because see, this swing low came after this low and after this high. Grab our little medallion there and drag it over to that most recent swing high. Okay? By the way, guys, I'm catching all of this on tape, so if you need to go back and look at it later, you can. Okay. All right. So we know that a potential long trade is 361.50 to 363. But we're looking for a short trade. What if price continues downward? Well, 349.50 is a Fibonacci projected price. 345.90 is a Fibonacci projected price target. All done on a daily chart, therefore subject to daily volatility. Well, what's that? I'll show you. Insert, indicators, volatility, average true range. Make sure you use the default period of 14, or if you're going to change it, have a good reason why. Okay. Okay. Now, what this tells us is that the average daily candle in this market has a range of $5.77. That's based over the last 14 days. If we were looking at a 1-minute chart, this number would reflect the size of a candle, of a one-minute candle, over the last 14 minutes. This were an hourly chart, the last 14 hours. Why do I say leave it at the default? Only because every trading platform I've ever looked at had 14 as the default. So for me to go and look at 21 because it's a fib number, I'm kind of fooling myself because I'm looking at something that nobody else is looking at. And the rest of the world, all the other traders sitting at this big old table with me, they're going to make their decisions based on what they can know and what they can see. And so I need, in this case, I need to know what they're seeing, okay? So the current volatility in this market is $5.77 on average per day. And so if we get a break to the downside from 353 to 349, is there $6 there from 53 to 49? No, not quite. How about from 53 to 45? That's a little more than the average daily range. So, how do we trade this? Shrink this. Actually, now that we know what we need to know, we'll just get this off of our screen. Okay. Open up our real estate. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to shrink this. Oh, we can only shrink it so far, though. Yeah. I don't know if there's a continuous contract, but let me check. @ L, there is. Sometimes these continuous charts work well and sometimes they don't. Let's see. Okay. Now, this is good. Because now we can see not just the K contract, but we can, anytime you want to do a continuous, DT Pro, if you want to know if it has a continuous contract, you type @ and then E. Those are all continuous contracts. We're on L for lumber. Okay. So that's the one we want, the one we're on. Let's just get out of here and hit cancel because we've already got it. Okay. All right. What we're going to do now is we're going to come down to this next target and we're going to look left. There's a swing low over here. Now, this range changed as well when we brought in this additional information. Did you guys see that? Okay. But we're trading the current contract. For now, I'm going to base this information on that. But watch this. From the 50, if we go across here, we can make a nice little straight line. 50% price projection runs right into this bottom. All right, so if we are going to establish this as a target, where do we want to enter? Again, we look left for that information. Going to draw a little line from this swing low over here. Going to make a straight line. The swing low of this candle is 352.10. I don't want to get in at 352.10. I want to get in a little bit below that. So, instead of 352.10, let's go down to 352 as a starting point. Okay. And now, the low of this candle is 350.20. Okay. So, I've got, watch what I do here. I've got a swing low on this candle of 352.10. I'm going to write that down. 352.10. Then on this candle, I've got, because this is a support area, I've got a low 350.20. All right. If I take a dime off the top, that's 352. If I, no, let's do 20 cents. No. Nah, yeah, we can go. Let's go 350, 30. Yeah, that's what we'll do. All right, the number is going to be 352. Now, the reason I took the dime and subtracted a dime and added a dime because I want cushioning. I want some cushion. I want the market to have to go a little bit further to show me that it's really serious about making this move. Does that mean I'm always going to be right? No. Does it mean there's a high probability that I'm going to be on the right side of the trade? Yeah, that's why we do it. Okay, so let's draw a little box over here. And we can consider being short 352 to 350.30. That's $1.70, okay? It's a potential $1.70 move. What about down here? Let's go hunting. Our next major swing low is way down here at 342. This candle, there's no friction. See, if we come off of this 50 here and look left, back to here, yeah, we could make something out of this low. The low of this candle is 348. That's information. Let's use it. Okay? The swing low of this candle is 348. So let's go 347.90. 347.90. 347.90. Okay? Now, look left. We're above this high, we're above this low, and we're above this low. And so, that's a beautiful thing, but I'm still going to add that dime. So, 345.90 plus a dime becomes 346. $347.90 to $346. Okay. All right. And then we take, just draw our little box, put it in here, and pop it in the box. Little arrow so we know the direction. Okay. We can now file this away. We can print it out, pin it up on our wall, however you like to organize things, keep them in your field of vision. Maybe you use a little app like Evernote that you've tied it into that website, if this, then that, so that when lumber hits a certain price, it will alert you. Your phone will go ding, ding. You'll open it up, and you'll go, oh, man, lumber just hit my – and, of course – you don't want it to alert you at the number you plan to enter. You want it to alert you a little before that so you have time to get to your computer and, you know, with a clear head, make sure you know what you're going to do. The good news is as price approaches one of these areas, you don't have to do any thinking. Okay, if price starts to drop, there's no more thinking. We've already done the thinking, okay? There's nothing that can happen because we're basing all of this off of previous price action. So there's nothing, if the market starts to fall, there's nothing that can happen that's going to change my idea that 352 to 350.30 is a high probability trade. Additionally, now I do want to get flat here at this 50% mark where we're tagging these bottoms. Okay, I do not want to be in the market there. So if I have profits from 352 to 350.30, $1.70 times whatever per tick, take my profit, go to the sideline, okay? If price continues down without having to do any additional thinking or calculations, I know that 347.90 to 346 is a high probability setup. Does a high probability setup mean you're going to the bank? No, it doesn't. Trading's not easy, but it can be simple. What I just showed you takes a very complex thing. You know, you could have a room full of men with calculators and slide rules and algorithms, and they could be fighting and arguing amongst themselves. And I'm not bragging, but at the end of the day, whatever number their machine spits out, it's not going to be much better than this number. Why? Because what I just did, our entire methodology, our indicator set embraces the underlying rhythm of the market. I don't want to sound too simplistic here, but the market can only do two things. It can do three. Yes, it can go sideways for a while. Hey, we have evidence. It chopped around up here for quite some time. So it can go sideways, but we also identified that inside of that sideways chop, once we identified that's what it was, once we knew the top of the range and the bottom of the range, we could have played that thing every day or traded it every day if we were lumber traders, okay? And so no matter how much calculating they do and probability things they run and statistical whatnots, and their little machine at the end of the day spits out a final number, I'll pit this number and this number against their number any day. And again, I don't say that to boast or brag. No. Because the market can only go up or down. Can go sideways for a little while. If the sideways range is big enough, that's tradable. Okay? Price is always going to respect previous areas of support and resistance. Sometimes it'll blow through it like it's not there. That's because there's either unusual buying or selling pressure in the market. That's why it's not a 100% business. That's why you have to accept that once you've done your very best work, if you can in fact be on the right side of the trade 60, 65% of the time, 70% of the time, now you're getting into Holy Grail territory. And I'm not talking about, you know, on some webinar or some website. I'm talking about in real life, okay? Reality. It just doesn't get much better than that. That's what it is, okay? If we break to the upside, if this thing does a reversal, pops back up into the range, we know that initially its job is to try to get to the middle of the range. That's how ranges work. Once it gets to the middle of the range, it becomes a 50-50 coin flip, whether it's going to continue to the top or turn around and go back down. If it continues up, we want the market to prove to us just a little bit, and in this case, we identified 60 as the middle of the range we were working with. So we're asking it, you know, show me 61.50. Then I'm willing to pay real money to see if you can go to 63. But at 63, I'm heading for the hills. Because these people up here who were astute enough to be sellers and profit on this all the way down, if price comes back up into this neck of the woods, they've sold it off once, twice, three. They had a real party with it this last time. Market has a memory. They're going to sell it again. Chances are they'll come in early. The sellers will. Now, if there is some incredibly fundamental bullish news out there driving the price of lumber higher, it may overwhelm the selling pressure, and the early selling. Remember the pattern. We typically see early selling come in, which will knock it down a bit. We'll then see a second wave of buyers come along and push it up to test the actual number, and then that becomes the make or break point. Who has the most strength, buyers or sellers? If sellers have the most strength, then it's coming back to the middle of the range, and then it becomes a coin flip, whether it's going to the top or to the bottom. Okay? So there you have it. Two trades on the, you know what? I can give you one more upside target. And then I'm going to be done. Insert. Tools. Price extensions. We'll go from this swing low to this swing high right there. And we'll grab our little medallion and we'll come down to this swing low right there. Okay. Once we get up through this area, 6150 to 63, once we take out the top, we've got this area right here. Okay. See, I'm getting inside of this candle, and I even have the luxury of getting inside of the candle behind it and the candle behind it, all three of them. There's enough room up here to give me that luxury. So the top of this candle, let's see, let me move this little thing. You guys can't see it, but it's in my way, so I got to move it down. All right. 368.80. I've already done my shaving. $368.80. And then down here. Oh, that's $366.80. No. That's $66.80. This is $68.80. So 3, 66, 80, 2, 3, 68, 80. So now we have two trades in each direction. Okay? So if you're having dinner with one of your friends and he says, "Hey, so what do you think about lumber?" You can tell him. Well, if it breaks below, you know, the recent range we've been trading inside of, we broke out of it today. You know, if we close below it, yeah, me and the boys, we're going to short 352 down to 350.30. If you're like me, the chance of you knowing anybody that would ever ask you that kind of question over dinner, it's like slim to none. They would just look at me with a real blank stare and go, "Huh?" Because their lumber comes from Home Depot. Me, I don't even buy lumber because I'm not a handyman. My wife buys lumber. She can walk in and go, "Oh, I need a 2x4 and a 1x6, and she can come home and build stuff. She really is. She's our handyman. I have bought her tool kits for Valentine's Day, and she loved them. She's that kind of gal. All right. Just to recap, on May lumber. Been trading in a range for a period of time. Looks like we may have broken out of that range to the downside. The market obviously isn't closed yet, so we're going to let the market close. As long as we don't put in a lower price, we don't have to change anything. Okay? If we put in a lower low than where we did our calculation, we would have to come back in and recalculate. So again, you could print this chart, stick it on your wall, keep an eye on lumber, and if lumber gets up to 360, 150, you don't even have to think about it. You either call your broker or place the order yourself to be long 6150 to 63. If it can get through this troublesome, worrisome area, then you know the next trade is a $2 trade, 6680 to 6880. Okay? If price continues on the downside, 352 to 35030, it's a $1.70 trade. And if it continues down, then 347.90 to 346, that is a $1.90 trade. Okay? Now, does anybody have any questions? I will answer. I'm just typing in a message here. Somebody just popped into my other chat room, and they said, I'm poking around your site, and it looks very subjective. It is not subjective. We identify every trade to the tick. Identify every trade entry to the tick. Okay, back to you guys. Any questions? Let me go to, I got so many chat boxes floating around here. Let me get an assistant someday. Where can I adjust the alert, Dwayne? Robert, if you're talking about the alert on DT Pro, I don't know. You can use another, you can use a website. It's called If This, Then That. And it's, the acronym is like, If This, Then That.com. So it's ITTT.com. If This, Then That. You can go in there and program that thing to tell you that when the price of a certain commodity or stock or something else hits a certain price, sends you an email, sends you a text alert, and it doesn't. It's not just for markets; it's for every aspect of life. You can, you know, just go look at it. It's a newer website. It's very all the cool kids are using it, and every day it brings on more channels, and you can do more things with it. If This, Then That.com. Check it out. Okay. Careful lumber is a New York market and fairly thin and not rational. It can get locked up for days. Yeah, that's why I don't trade it. Okay. I started it out. Someone in the audience said, hey, can you do an analysis on lumber? And I said, sure. I said I would do one market for whoever asked first. I don't trade lumber for partially that very reason. It is a thin market. You can get locked limit up or down for days. Thank you, Wayne, for reminding me of the reason why I don't participate in this market. But it doesn't mean I can't go in and do technical analysis, read the chart, and then define the high probability trades. We can do that with every market. Dwayne, how would you use the fibs to project an extended down move? Okay, Ken, I just did that for you. Jim says, I was thinking short big time. Okay, Jim, well, just keep in mind that you're going to run into support from this move down. You got definite support right here. People who bought this market and ran it up, they're down here waiting. They've already taken their profits. That's why price fell off. They took their profits. They're down here camped out. They're waiting. And when price gets within striking distance, they're going to pounce on that thing, man, and they're going to do everything in their power to run it back up again so they can make another busload of money. Okay? So watch that area. Now, if they run it up, take profits early, run out of buying strength, whatever, then you got to watch this area. Because if price can somehow get back down to this area, 342, you're going to see the same thing, but with even greater enthusiasm. Why? Well, because if you can buy this thing at or near 342, the distance to the next swing high based on historics is all the way up at 375. You can buy the Ponderosa with that money, you know, depending on how many contracts you got going. So, I think I've covered it all. All right, guys. With that, where can I review this session? I will get it uploaded to youtube.com/CFRN. Probably not today. Maybe today. I'm a little behind, as you know. I stay busy, work a lot of hours, but that's okay. I'm not complaining. I'll get it uploaded, though, as soon as I can. Once it's on youtube.com/CFRN, it will also be mirrored over on our blog at CFRN.net. Guys, if you haven't taken the free trial, you should get busy. You should take the free, get off the couch, Tater. It's time to take control of your financial destiny. And I would love to be a part of that journey. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Whoever you are, wherever you are, may God continue to richly bless you with His mercy and with His grace. And I'll see you at the bell.
Remember this. There is no greater return on investment than to see a human life changed and given hope. As always, pray hard and trade safe. Any financial information discussed on this show is simply the opinion of our host, Dwayne Reeves, his co-hosts, and guests. To learn more about trading e-mini futures or to take a one-week free trial in our live trading room, call 1-866-928-3310. 866-928-3310. Information discussed on this radio program should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Always do your own due diligence and consult with a licensed securities broker or financial planner before making any investment decisions.